Hey there, podcast listeners. This is Ann Althaus, your podcaster, your blogger. It's a Saturday morning here in Madison, Wisconsin, and wherever you are as well. And I'd like to begin looking at the posts this morning with what is a kind of an advice column in the New York Times. The advice columnist is Roxanne Gay, and I begin the post with a quote from the comments. So Roxanne Gay gets a letter from somebody and then writes in response to that, and then somebody in the comments over at the New York Times says something that I picked out and made the title of my post. So this is a quote from someone who identifies herself as a woman and an assistant professor somewhere. And she says, quote, "I am quietly horrified by how fashionable it is to demean men in the academic setting and popular press. I heard a faculty colleague laughing about all the mediocre white men in our shared course, and it broke my heart, because even white men are people too," close quote. And, you know, I'm just surprised that a teacher would look at the students and call them mediocre. I mean, it's your school, it's your class. Presumably you're responsible for who are the students at your school, or maybe you're at a school that people who aren't mediocre don't go to. But if you look out on your class and they look like dull, bored people, you don't know what they really are. Maybe you're boring. Maybe you're making them seem mediocre. If I looked out at my class — I'm now a retired law professor — but if I looked out on my class and I thought people looked dull and mediocre, I would feel responsible that it was something about the way I was teaching the class. I don't know what these people are like when they're free and out and about in their normal life, as opposed to their student classroom life. But anyway, it is disturbing if you're going to criticize them specifically by their race and sex. Mediocre white men. So many mediocre white men. Well, are there mediocre women? Are there mediocre black people? I'm sure they're mediocre people. The mediocre are a lot of the people that are out there, but why would you laugh at them? You know, they're paying to go to your school and to take your class. So what if mediocre people are seeking a higher education? Why would you laugh at them? Help them. And shouldn't college be lifting people up to be non-mediocre because they've encountered the great wisdom that you're imparting through your class? Otherwise, why are they going to school? Why are they paying tuition? But that's all coming out of the comment. And to get into the advice column per se, let's look at what this letter was and how the columnist Roxanne Gay responded to the letter writer. So the chosen problem, because they don't just answer all the letters they get, they chose this and they put it first in this column. The chosen problem from a woman who works on a relatively diverse gender balanced team at a job she loves is that the work itself does not feel fair. Because, quote, "within the project teams I'm a part of, it falls to women to take notes, organize their colleagues, and make sure work gets done with regular check-ins and meetings," close quote. And so Roxanne Gay, the columnist, the advice columnist, says, quote, "if a natural, equitable system isn't manifesting, assign people specific responsibilities. Stop assuming everything will fall apart if you don't hold it together. Stop coddling grown men. Prioritize your own work and ambition more than you prioritize the man babies you work with," close quote. And I said, I don't really understand the answer, because it seems to me that to assign people specific responsibilities is to assume you're the one that must hold it together and impose the proper order, the equitable system that didn't emerge naturally. The problem seems to be the familiar group project problem, where some people hold back and let the more anxious overachievers get most of the work done. That's a natural order, isn't it, among the human beings? I mean, if you want to talk about what natural system would manifest itself — notice how impersonal that is — if a natural equitable system isn't manifesting, assign people specific responsibilities. So the idea that the people would on their own start doing things in a way that was fair with the work evenly distributed is kind of funny. Obviously, people don't do that. People are only too happy to stand back and let the overeager workers do more. That always happens. So why does it happen in a gender disparate way? Well, there are a lot of reasons you could talk about why that happens. Well, who takes charge? Who assigns work? But it's not going to emerge naturally that people are going to do everything evenly. People are going to try to get the part of the work that they like and not get stuck with what they don't like. But why does it break down gender-wise? Why do women take over in one way? But I think there are slackers in every group, and there are overeager people in every group. It's just the problem of group projects. Why there must be teams at work? I don't really know what kind of work they're doing or why it has to be done in teams, why it has to be done this way. And why does it just happen that it calls to women to take notes, organize their colleagues, and make sure work gets done with regular check-ins and meetings? Is that natural? And an underlying question is whether all the note-taking and meetings and regular check-ins really need to be done. I mean, who decides that there must be note-taking, that there must be check-ins and meetings? Who's enthusiastic about meetings here? I mean, there's just some underlying questions that Roxane Gay is not examining. She's just jumping to decide that the men are man babies and that they're allowing you to get into coddling mode. What's really going on? I mean, there's just not enough curiosity about what the real dynamic is here, how human beings really do relate to each other. You should never assume, and one thing that the traditional advice columnists like Dear Abby would do, is they never assumed that the point of view presented by the letter writer was correct. They tried to read between the lines. So often somebody who's doing something inappropriate or wrong or misjudging things is writing the letter. And you have to look through that and see that. You can't just side with the letter writer. You have to think, well, she's putting it this way, but she's talking about some people who aren't represented here in the conversation. Let's try to think of their point of view. And maybe in feminist analysis, it happens that if the woman is writing the letter and talking about men, you just would be kind of suckered into automatically siding with the woman and taking the negativity toward the men for what it's, as it's presented by the letter writer, and not try to use your imagination to construct the other person's point of view. Because why should men get that? They've been advantaged too much throughout history. So if their point of view is unrepresented, good. Maybe you like that. And I'm not saying I think that's good. I think that's wrong. I think you should always try to visualize the perspective of the person who isn't present in the conversation, especially if somebody is demeaning that person and criticizing them. How do we know the person who's making the complaint is right and the person who's missing is wrong? It's just basic ethics to do that. It's amazing when that isn't done, and it's terrible if feminism works to cause that not to be done. Oh, it's the woman that's speaking to me, so I'll accept what she's saying because the person who isn't speaking is a man, so screw him. Then we'll get even. It's revenge for turning the tables and being as unfair to them as they were to us. I don't think that's a very good approach to ethics. And I said, you could look at this problem from different angles. One, women could be oppressing men by expecting work to be done with excessive meetings and documentation and bureaucracy. People who resist inefficiency are not necessarily babyish. And it isn't just women versus men here. I was a woman in the workplace before I retired, and I didn't like the people who wanted a lot of meetings and allowed meetings to go on and did things in this overly methodical way without really getting efficiently toward the actual substantive work product. It's like there was some value to meeting itself as opposed to as a means to an end. And if there are people who insist on having meetings like that, the people who think it's inefficient and don't like it might seem a little babyish, might seem bulky, but maybe we could get this all out in the open and have it out so that the people who love the meetings and don't notice the inefficiency have to face up to some of their own limitations. 2, men could end up coddling grown women if they get the message that men violate gender equity norms when they don't go along with the expectation that work be done with lots of stultifying meetings and note-taking. So what I'm saying there is if people like the letter writer are given more of what they want, they're kind of getting coddling too. I mean, why don't we call them women babies? Isn't it babyish to think that your way is the way it ought to be? And then and you will get coddled in that if you propound successfully this feminist notion that we're moving toward gender equity by allowing these endless meetings and this elaborate note-taking and the checking in and the regular status updates to be a major part of what you're doing at work. So I think there's a lot missing from that column. It's so simplistic and annoying. Anyway, what else have we got here? I see that we were talking about Justice Alito's Federalist Society speech yesterday, and I noticed today in the New York Times there was an article in unusually political speech, Alito says, liberals pose threat to liberties. The conservative justices' pointed remarks, which he made in a speech to the Federalist Society, reflected thoughts he has expressed in his opinions. And what I pulled out of that article was a quote from the Harvard Law professor, Mark Tushnet. And here's that quote. The very intensity of Justice Alito's remarks seems to me to confirm my judgment about who won the culture wars. His are, in fact, the observations of a person who hasn't come to grips with the fact that he's been on the losing side of many culture war issues. And I quote from Alito's speech where Tushnet is mentioned. So the New York Times went to Tushnet because Alito refers to him without saying his name. He is the Harvard professor that Alito refers to in this in the speech. And I'm going to read a little bit from the speech, which includes a reference to Tushnet, although not his name. The question we face is whether our society will be inclusive enough to tolerate people with unpopular religious beliefs. Over the years, I have sat on cases involving the rights of many religious minorities, Muslim police officers whose religion required them to have beards, a Native American who wanted to keep a bear for religious services, a Jewish prisoner who tried to organize a Torah study group. A Harvard Law professor provided a different view of a future America. He candidly wrote, quote, "The culture wars are over. They lost, we won. The question now is how to deal with the losers in the culture war. My own judgment is the taking a hard line, you lost live. My own judgment is that taking a hard line, you lost, live with it, is better than trying to accommodate the losers. Taking a hard line seemed to work reasonably well in Germany and Japan after 1945. Is our country going to follow that course? To follow a popular Nobel laureate, it's not dark yet, but it's getting there." And I said, Alito seems to like to refer to people without naming them. The Harvard Law School professor was Mark Tushnet. Who was the Nobel laureate? Well, it was Bob Dylan. The song Not Dark Yet is from, I think it's Time Out of Mind album. And I thought about it a little more, and I wanted to quote something else from Bob Dylan. I said, hey, Professor Tushnet, you say the war is over and you won and the other guy is the loser. But the Nobel laureate says, don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changing. So the idea would be Tushnet is saying the war's over. We won. It's over because we won. I mean, everyone wants to say, oh, game's over now, at the point when you're winning. But the game, what causes the game to be over? It's not over. You may declare that it's over because at this point you've won, but the wheel is still in spin. And the culture war that you think you've won, you might be left behind as the culture war rolls on and on. You might think, well, I was with those people. They may be looking back at you and say, no, you are the loser. You may think you were with them when they crossed the line that you thought was the victory line, but things kept going, and maybe you got left behind, and you'll be the loser. So the first will be last, and the last first. That's something Jesus said. Now, speaking of Jesus, there's another Bob Dylan song, Property of Jesus, and I quoted it in a separate post. I have a separate post called Loser. Professor Tushnet and Justice Alito got me looking for the Dylan songs containing the word loser. There are four such songs, and the one that worked for that post was The Times They Are Changing. What are the other three loser songs? Well, they're Black Diamond Bay, Property of Jesus, and Desolation Row. From Black Diamond Bay. Then the Greek appears on the second floor in his bare feet with a rope around his neck, while a loser in the gambling room lights up a candle, says, open up another deck. From Property of Jesus, say that he's a loser because he's got no common sense, because he don't increase his worth at someone else's expense, because he's not afraid of trying, because he don't look at you and smile, because he doesn't tell you jokes or fairy tales. Say he's got no style. He's the property of Jesus. And from Desolation Row, probably my favorite of these songs, Dr. Filth, he keeps his world inside of a leather cup, but all his sexless patients, they're trying to blow it up. Now his nurse, some local loser, she's in charge of the cyanide hole, and she also keeps the cards that read, have mercy on his soul. I liked coming up with the word soul in that song as well, because there's been a lot of talk lately about the restoration of America's soul. There's been this wild, bizarre notion that the presidential election was a battle for America's soul. That's a concept that the Biden campaign put on it. And there's been speeches about how the America has a soul, and the soul of America must be restored. So this interest in the soul is something I'm watching, especially I think there's a lot of fakeness to this idea of a soul. Have mercy on his soul. She keeps the cards. She's in charge of the cyanide hole. She also keeps the cards that read, have mercy on his soul. That's the nurse. But remember, the nurse is some local loser. Not only is she a loser, she's a local loser. Okay, enough of Bob Dylan there for now. Let's consider, speaking of losing weight. I see that there's an article in the New York Times, heavy on the New York Times this morning, an op-ed by Aubrey Gordon, leave fat kids alone. The war on childhood obesity has only caused shame. So she goes on and on about how terrible it is to put any kind of pressure or send any kind of message to children that they're fat. You know, it's only going to make them feel bad about themselves. So don't do it. What to do about their health is another matter, but she's just totally on this idea of you're hurting their minds. Leave fat kids alone. But here's the part that I excerpted. The war on childhood obesity reached its zenith with the 2010 introduction of the national Let's Move campaign, dedicated to solving the problem of obesity within a generation. It was a campaign against childhood obesity, not specific health conditions or the behaviors that may contribute to those health conditions. It wasn't a campaign against foods with little nutritional value or against the unchecked poverty that called for such low-cost, shelf-stable foods. It was a campaign against a body type, specifically children's body types. And I said, this is the most negative thing about Michelle Obama I have ever seen in the New York Times. Not that the op-ed ever says the name Michelle Obama. I was going to check to see if the comments over there bring up Michelle Obama, but there are no comments on this piece. Perhaps that's to protect Michelle Obama, but probably also to protect the author of the op-ed from any shaming, the op-ed being staunchly anti-shame. But here's the Wikipedia article on Let's Move. It begins, Let's Move was a public health campaign in the United States led by Michelle Obama, wife of then President Barack Obama. So I was just amazed to see this attack on Let's Move as if it was the worst thing ever when it was the main thing that Michelle Obama made a project out of when she was first lady. And it seems to me that it was about food and exercise and wanting people to be more generally healthy. But the op-ed writer, Aubrey Gordon, acts like it was just getting after kids for having the wrong body type. Now, the first post that went up this morning began with an image, a photograph of the inside of a hiking diary from Earl Schaefer. This goes back to 1948, and Earl Schaefer was the first person to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail. In other words, walk the entire way on a single consecutive hiking experience. And I love seeing the diary, and if you go over to the link, which goes to the Smithsonian website, you can see pictures of every page of his diary. I think that's really cool to see someone's handwriting, a book that he carried the whole way, 2,000 miles of walking in 100 and some days. And I was reading about Schaefer this morning in an article at Gaia GPS by Abby Levine called Walking Off the War on the Appalachian Trail. And one of the things that Schaefer was doing was to walk the war out of my system. So he came back from World War II and then undertook this long walk, showed that it could be done by a person, which people hadn't thought before, but he did. And he was motivated to walk the war out of his system. From the article, quote, he traveled alone, walking around 17 miles a day. Schaefer packed light. He nixed a tent when he realized his poncho could double as a shelter. He mended his clothes and cooked cornbread in a pan over an open fire. Schaefer made it over rocks, roots, and rubble in just one pair of Russell Moccasin Company bird shooter boots. He resold them twice, and they were in tatters by the end. And I looked it up. You can still buy Russell Moccasin Company bird shooter boots, and I was pleased to see that they're made in Wisconsin, Berlin, Wisconsin. I think we say Berlin, Wisconsin, not Berlin, B-E-R-L-I-N. This is one of these American towns that has the same name as a place somewhere else in the world, but I don't think it's pronounced Berlin. I think it's pronounced Berlin. Anyway, the article says that Schaefer's motivation was to walk the war out of my system. And the main focus of the article is Sean Gobin, a Marine veteran who thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail and thinks it was good for his mental health. He did this much more recently. Your brain really, he says, your brain really has nothing to do but start to focus on your life experiences and what you've gone through. You come to terms with it and then start focusing on the future and what you want to do with your life, what's really important to you. It was this really personal, cathartic experience. And let me say, I go running in the morning, and I started my ritual of running every morning to see the sunrise. I started that I would listen to a music playlist that I'd put together that I thought went well with the experience of running at dawn. And then I changed the playlist to this and that way to give me things that I thought would work better. But then I stopped using music. I took the headphones out and I found it was much better to listen to nothing. And that with nothing to listen to, the mind just found things to think about. And you could really think about a lot of things, even in, well, the run that I do only takes half an hour. But You think a lot of things in half an hour. So if you were walking for whatever it took to get 17 miles a day, maybe 8 hours, 12 hours, what would it take? It's hard to walk 17 miles, but let's say he, but hours and hours a day. Let's say you were just walking and you just in the company of your own mind. What would you think about? What would go on in your mind? I mean, there is just so much more that your mind would do if you gave it that much time. Like maybe drive across country if you're a little less physical, and don't turn on the radio, don't play audiobooks. What will you think? You'll think a lot more. But I can't help but feel if I were out there trying to walk the Appalachian Trail, I'd end up listening to audiobooks, and my mind would just be plugged into these elaborate things, thoughts of other people, just to give me something to think about. You have to go into that deprivation condition where you're not listening to things, and then your mind is really set alive. Just to repeat his quote, your brain really has nothing to do but start to focus on your life experiences and what you've gone through. You come to terms with it and then start focusing on the future and what you want to do with your life, what's really important to you. It was this really personal, cathartic experience. Think about that the next time you want to put those earphones in. He worked with the Appalachian Trail Conservancy to bring the benefit of thru hiking to other veterans. His group is called Warrior Expeditions. Describing the first group to do the hike, which he'd seen at the beginning and then at the end, he said, quote, "The people I met in Maine were not the same people who started in Georgia." You know, when you do the Appalachian Trail, you could go north to south or south to north, but most people start in Georgia and end in Maine. So the people he walked with them a little bit in Georgia to start, and then he met them at the end of the trail at Mount Katahdin when they had finished. And he said, "The people I met in Maine were not the same people who started in Georgia." And maybe whenever you go on any walk, the person at the end of that walk is not the person who started it. Ever think about it that way? Sometimes I think every morning when you wake up, maybe you're a different person. But every walk could begin and end with a, it's sort of like you never step in the same river twice. But you know what he meant. He meant something a little grander than that. The people I met in Maine were not the same people who started in Georgia. Physically, they had lost tons of weight. Was he body shaming? Physically, they had lost tons of weight. The pudgy vets who started up the trail no longer had an ounce of body fat. And their eyes, wow, it was like someone turned the lights on. So there's a notion that maybe when people come back from military service, they don't have the discipline that they experienced within the military, and they don't have the physical demands, and so they just start to put on weight and they start to lose their fitness. They feel bad about that. They feel bad about a lot of things, perhaps. But it's possible that hiking the Appalachian Trail, through hiking the Appalachian Trail, deals with many multiple problems that one might have if you've served in the military and are out of the military. The article says hiking with a heavy pack all day, every day, helps burn off anxiety. Now, I thought that was very interesting because I've read Bill Bryson's book, A Walk in the Woods, which is about attempting to through hike the Appalachian Trail. Spoiler alert, he doesn't do it. There's a lot of complaint in that about how bad it is to have the pack. I think he says it's like carrying a chest of drawers on your back. It's you never stop thinking about it. It's really bad that you're doing this walk, but you have this heavy pack. This article says that the heavy pack helps burn off anxiety. Kind of reminds me of that autistic designer Temple Grandin, who built the different mechanisms for easing cattle into the slaughterhouse, and it had to do with something she learned about herself with pressure on her body, that she felt relaxed with the pressure. Maybe hiking with a heavy pack is like having one of those pressure machines that she designed for herself. But someone with a certain type of anxiety might feel soothed by carrying a heavy pack. Well, that's certainly convenient because carrying a heavy pack sounds like an awful part, the worst part of attempting to go on a long hike like that. But here it might be, maybe it is exactly what's good for you, that the heavy pack burns off your anxiety. Is anxiety a thing that can be burned? You have anxiety, it's like fuel inside you, but if you used it for something, you could hike a long way and get rid of the anxiety. Back to the article. The physical toll and time in nature alleviates depression. The routine puts hikers on a normal sleep schedule where they're up with the sun and sleep when the sun sets. That's what I do. Plus, they're tired. They're so tired they actually get a good night's sleep. It's very structured, Gobin says. It strips away all the things in life that are unnecessary. It breaks life down to its most basic elements. And I said, breaking life down to its most basic elements is an idea you see in Thoreau's Walden. And one of the most famous lines in the book, he says, I wanted to reduce life to its lowest terms. So, and let me read you the whole sentence. It's one of these long 19th century sentences. I had diagram it because I think this was the kind of thing that diagramming was invented for. How can you get through a sentence like this? How can you see the structure of this sentence? But you can see it if you look at it on the blog, but you'll have to hear it because I'm about to read it. Okay, this is one of the greatest sentences in Thoreau's Walden, and it has that idea of breaking life down to its most basic elements, or as Thoreau put it, reducing life to its lowest terms. Makes it sound like a math problem. Okay, ready for the sentence. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms, and if it proved to be mean, why then to get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world, or if it were sublime, to know it by experience and be able to give a true account of it in my next excursion. Close quote. Was that last part a belief in reincarnation? When he gets to the end of life, he's talking about his whole life. Is life sublime? I want to know it. If it's mean, I want to know it and tell you about it. I want to know what it is and be able to give a true account of it in my next excursion. Does that mean in my next life? I'm not sure. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life. So you want your life to be life. I don't want anything in my life that isn't life. Now you could say, well, that's impossible. Whatever you're doing is life. Life is life. No matter how much you're wasting your life, what stupid affairs you've involved yourself in, how many you're sitting there at a meeting and it goes on and on because someone that you don't want to feel that you're a sexist is insisting that we sit there for 2 hours and go over and over and over everything and please take notes. That's life too. No, but I don't think that's what he means. I think that would be labeled not life, put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close, to drive life into a corner. It's like he's in a battle with life. He's going to drive life into a corner. He wants to see what it is and reduce it to its lowest terms. I want to know what it is. And if it proved to be mean, why then to get the whole and genuine meanness of it? If it's bad, I want the full experience of its badness and publish its meanness to the world. And I'll tell everybody about it on your blog. Easily, I'm sure someone's already done this, put Walden in blog form. Just put a couple of paragraphs a day up. I'm just giving you one sentence. I think it makes a pretty good blog post, just this one sentence, as I'm rereading it, stopping all over the place and talking about it. And if it proved to be mean, why then to get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world? Or if it were sublime, to know it by experience and be able to give a true account of it in my next excursion. And I said, and yes, I have read Bill Bryson's A Walk in the Woods, and I know he insults Thoreau. So here's the, because I knew if I just put that Thoreau stuff there, because the thing that Gobin said reminded me of it. Remember, Gobin said, break life down to its most basic elements, and Thoreau said, reduce life to its lowest terms. I just wanted to talk about that, but I knew if I stopped there, someone in the comments would surely say Bryson insulted Thoreau, or they might just directly insult Thoreau in a pretty similar way. Anyway, here's what Bryson said about Thoreau. The inestimably priggish and tiresome Henry David Thoreau thought nature was splendid, splendid indeed, so long as he could stroll to town for cakes and barley wine. But when he experienced a real wilderness on a visit to Katahdin in 1846, he was unnerved to the core. This wasn't the tame world of overgrown orchards and sun-dappled paths that passed for wilderness in suburban Concord, Massachusetts, but a forbidding, oppressive, primeval country that was grim and wild, savage and dreary, fit only for men nearer of kin to the rocks and wild animals than we. The experience left him, in the words of one biographer, near hysterical. And I'll just say, I think that's a little bit sexist, because I think saying that he seems like a woman, right? It's between the lines. Hysterical, priggish, tiresome, preferring overgrown orchards and sun-dappled paths. It's saying, oh, Henry David Thoreau, what a mama's boy, what a baby. He couldn't take the real woods, grim and wild, savage and dreary. Well, he was able to put into words how scary a forest, a deep forest, can feel. And that was some good writing. I like Bryson's writing too. I especially like Bryson when listening to audiobooks, because he puts the humor into the words. The words really come to life with his style of reading. I don't buy the audio. If I have an audiobook and it's not done by him, it just doesn't have the same feeling at all. The whole thing seems dead. Seems to be not Bryson. I would put to rout all Bryson works that are not Bryson, and he needs to be reading his own work. Much more comes out of it. Much more of the spirit of it comes out if he's doing the reading. But I've never heard Thoreau read his own work. I don't have any audiobooks where Thoreau is reading Walden. Those were never recorded. Do we even have any idea what his voice sounded like? Maybe somebody described his voice once. But he knew that he had to speak to us through the words themselves. Words like grim and wild, savage and dreary. How does a forest seem to you? It might depend on why you're in the forest. Are you out there to get over the war? Are you out there to experience the aesthetic pleasures of nature? Are you traveling? Do you need to get one place to one place from another? Are you escaping from the Nazis? Do you ever, when you're out on a long walk and it's difficult going, think about, well, and you're only motivated by finishing it or getting back to the car or something like that. Do you ever think, well, imagine if I was in some desperate situation and I was escaping from I'm in some forbidding country where the government is against me and I'm trying to get out of here. I guess I've never seen the movie Sound of Music, but I know that they escape from the Nazis in the end. So do you ever, when you're on a long walk, start to visualize that you're actually in a desperate situation and you got to keep moving? If you think you're tired, if you were really in a situation like that, you would just be at the beginning. You wouldn't even admit that you were tired yet. You would feel that you were full of energy. I think the point at which, during a normal long walk, in our simple lives, at the point at which we're like slogging along and thinking, I can barely do this, I want to sit down, I want this to be over. If you were actually escaping from the Nazis and you felt like that, you would think you had plenty of energy and you were just at the beginning of what can be much, many, many, many more hours of hardcore walking, because you're not really tired. You're not tired in that really tired way that you would fall down if you were fast walking for your life. Okay, so the Nazis showed up twice in this trip through the posts of the morning, and only have one more post. No Nazis in it. In fact, it has nudes. It's called No Nudes is Good Nudes. And, you know, that's a corny old pun. I've always thought it was funny, No Nudes is Good Nudes. And we were talking about nudes the other day. Nudes and art and the difference between nude and naked. We had that nude sculpture by Maggie, Maggie Hambling, the British sculptor who had done a monument to Mary Wollstonecraft that had a nude in it. So we've been talking about nudes a lot lately. And one of the most famous artists who did nudes is Tom Wesselman from the 1960s. He was one of the great pop artists, and he has a whole series of paintings called Great American Nudes. And if you've ever seen them, you can remember his distinctive style. As I say in the post, longtime museum goers almost certainly associate Wesselman with vivid, forthright, great American nudes. Like, I linked to one, and the link goes to the Museum of Modern Art site, Great American Nude, number 75. But what I'm reading today is a New York Times article by Roberta Smith about the rearrangement of the various permanent galleries at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Now, I take out one paragraph and I say, I see what's going on here. Quote, the fourth floor gallery, with a mix of what most people would recognize as pop art, was previously from soup cans to flying saucers and is now domestic disruption. This gallery is far less discombobulated than its previous iteration, corroborating more convincingly the internationalism that is a recurring subtext on this floor. Tom Wesselman's scaled-up still life, number 57, is one of his best installation paintings, not least for containing no nudes. It is in dialogue with Noah Purifoy's Unknown, a balletic assemblage painting in which parasol armature radiates across saturated bands of green, yellow, and red. To the other side stands Beatrice Gonzalez's Lullaby, a metal baby crib painted enamel green with an appropriated image of mother and child. And I said, Still Life number 57, which you can see here, is a very large painting of a radio, an orange, and some daffodils. But longtime museum goers almost certainly associate Wesselman with vivid, forthright, great American nudes. Now, the nudes are banished. The galleries are rearranged. Wesselman will be known by an orange instead of the orange's shapemate, the breast. And it must be in dialogue with an African-American man's balletic parasol and a Hispanic woman's crib. I'm not looking at it, but it sounds like ham-handed inclusiveness. It sounds as though the white man is still the center of power. The arrangement seems like an exercise in diluting and offsetting him. That, ironically, is an expression of a deep, persistent belief in white male supremacy. So you see the irony of all of that? They're obvious. I mean, Roberta Smith doesn't, the New York Times writer, doesn't come out and even talk about this. She just says it's that the way they've redesigned the gallery is far less discombobulated. Right? What does that mean? It's more organized. She says it corroborates more convincingly with the internationalism that is a recurring subtext on this floor. Notice how strangely that is put. She's saying internationalism. You need internationalism in pop art. I mean, it's such an American kind of art, pop art. I don't know, maybe there's some other people elsewhere in the world, but what's wrong with the Americanness of pop art? And why is there some kind of an idea that, well, if we have this guy, this white man, we will take away what he's most famous for, these great nudes, and then we'll kind of dilute him and make him more domestic. We're even calling the gallery domestic disruption, making him more domestic by showing things that look like they'd be on some woman's kitchen table, a radio, an orange, and some daffodils. Obviously, Westman is interested in women. He's either showing nude women or he's showing these kind of objects that I would associate with women. Maybe not, but, you know, it looks like a kitchen. There's a kind of checkerboard patterned cloth underneath the objects. It's a still life. It's a still life of ordinary objects in a wholesome, fresh American kitchen. I think it's American. But I think he maybe had the similar attitude about the nudes too. But okay, so we've got him cut down to size and put into a still life. And then we have these objects, one from Noah Purifoy, and I looked it up, it's an African-American man. And Beatrice Gonzalez, she's a, I think, Guatemalan or Colombian. No, she's Colombian. And she's got something. And then notice the domesticness of it, that the Noah Purifoy's piece is referred to as a parasol-shaped item. And Gonzalez's piece is done with a baby crib, a painted baby crib and a mother and child. So they're obviously, it's like they were given an assignment to redo the pop art room with recognition of the gender and race issues that are so important in our, in the culture, the winning side of the culture war. But meanwhile, we have these great Tom Wesselman pieces in our permanent collection. We want to use them. That's what everybody's been coming to see for decades. But so we pick one that doesn't have a big nude in it, even though that's been such a popular exhibit in the Museum of Modern Art for a long time. And then, so we cut him down to size, and then we put it in dialogue with the Hispanic woman and the black man. It's still all circulating around the man. I mean, ironically, this is the irony for me, is that it's still about Tom Wesselman, because you put him first and then you balanced him, you offset him, and you diluted him. I think that's all rather absurd. And what of these nudes? Are they sexist? Is an artist who paints nude women, a male artist painting nude women, is he a sexist? I looked up to see if I'd ever written about Tom Wesselman before, and I did. I wrote about him in January of 2016. I was I took a quote from from an article in The Guardian titled "Great American Nudes Artist Tom Wesselman Was No Sexist," say the women in his life. And then I'm quoting from that. The idea that the great American nudes painter Tom Wesselman was sexist is so completely the opposite of who he was and how he treated women in real life. He had the same wife for so many years. And as their daughter, this is written by his daughter, right? That's the I here. He had the same wife for so many years. And as their daughter, I watched them be madly in love until he died. It was kind of disgusting. Everybody was like, how do they have this wonderful, perfect marriage? I mean, he's my dad, so I don't want to entirely think about it, but finding my mom, he was reawakened by sex. So I think that really was a driving force, this woman he loved and was completely attracted to. So think about those great nudes that way. This was a man who loved his wife for many years. I take it the woman in those pictures with the big smiling lipstick mouth and the out and proud body. That was his wife, and he completely loved her. It was just a picture of happiness and love. And now, no wife, no woman, radio.